Okay, the Economic Development Housing Budget Division for Monday, March 15th, 2010 will come to order. We have a quorum. Today is my dad's 91st birthday, also. I got to remember to call him.
How come you weren't at the party?
Huh? I was yesterday. We did one yesterday.
Was he having a party again today?
He probably is with my brother and my sister, but they're both up north.
It's their turn.
I'm here, yeah. Senator Scheid, which one of these you want to do first? 2170? Homeowner lender mediation requirements prior to mortgage foreclosure. Senator Scheid, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought this had a lower, I was going to say the one with the lower Senate file number, but no, that's not correct. This got reintroduced this year. You did see this bill last year. It's changed somewhat, but it is the homeowner lender mediation bill. And we had quite a lengthy discussion of it in your committee, but we did keep working on it, got it to the floor. It was amended in the other body at the beyond the 11th hour, the last night of session in 2009, and ultimately vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. This bill, let me tell you what this bill does. And this bill is in, I think it's actually almost precisely in the stage it was when it left the Senate and the House last year, but it's different than you had in committee. So this one does not increase the foreclosure time. What it does is in the matter of these foreclosures where there's been mediation, it shortens the redemption period from 6 months to 5 months.
Okay. So
yes. And it also exempts lenders. This has to do with requiring homeowner lender mediation in the case of foreclosure. I should have said that. I'm sorry. I think you're receiving, I think, a map, or you have a map of the city that I live in, and I think that is this year's map for 2009. Mm-hmm. The 2008 map had 1,005 foreclosures on it. I have 6 foreclosures out of my kitchen. Albeit I have a northern window and a western window. 6 foreclosed and empty homes that are visible from my house, from my kitchen. And I live in a decent, very nice, family-oriented neighborhood. Just give you an idea of the impact that foreclosure has had on the neighborhood I live in, the community I live in. And also, I don't have a map or numbers from Brooklyn Center, but they're proportional. And those are the two communities that I represent here in the Senate. It's hit our two communities very hard, but it really has hurt communities and neighborhoods all over this state, foreclosure. And so we offer this. It's an initiative out of the Attorney General's office. We offer this in the hopes of trying to save homes. I don't know if you had the bill last year to extend farmer lender mediation. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you had that or not. But we did do that last year, and that was passed originally in 1986. We have saved thousands of farms under the farmer lender mediation, and that continues to this day. We don't have it for homeowners.
I had a farm bill.
Pardon me?
I doubt I had a farm bill.
Well, okay.
Could have been.
I just wasn't sure, Mr. Chairman, if it would have had to go, I suppose, to some finance committee, but maybe not yours. Anyway, this, three years ago, we required counseling services be offered to people who are facing foreclosure. That stays in place. People can have the option to go through counseling, and they must be told they have an option then, after counseling, that they may also be eligible or are entitled to mediation. And some of the people interested here had quarrels with having that be a face-to-face meeting, so the language that left the House and Senate and went to the governor last year provided for telephonic mediations. It said that the initial mediation meeting would be conducted by telephone. if there were subsequent meetings, and I think my best guess is that there won't be a lot of subsequent meetings. I mean, I think these are going to be a 2 or 3 hour kind of, at the most, sessions with a mediator, the homeowner, and a representative of the lender. But subsequent meetings would be by telephone unless the mediator certifies that they want the people personally present for the mediation. This language before you exempts lenders with 5 or fewer foreclosures in the past year, past 12 months. And the bill, as it left this committee, had a penalty for creditor bad faith. That was that foreclosure would continue with the normal 6-month redemption period. But this language has a penalty for debtor bad faith, and that would require a deed in lieu of foreclosure within 90 days if the debtor exhibits bad faith. And getting down to, I think, what you are mostly concerned about in this committee is the mediations would be funded by a $125 fee paid with the filings of all foreclosures, all of which will not go to mediation, but because foreclosure is having such a dramatic and negative effect and impact on our communities and our neighborhoods, I feel it's fair that every lender filing foreclosure should pay this and share in this program to try to save as many homes as we can for homeowners. So that's where we are. And I have to tell you, I have now forgotten if we were twice this amount when we left last year. I think we were $250, and we are at $125 now. So, so that's my story.
So, Senator Scheid, I think you said that all of the $125 might not go to mediation. Is that because it goes to other things like reimbursing staff and administrative costs, and potentially if it's left over, there's something left over that it goes to the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to be misleading about that. No, not all of the people in foreclosure will use mediation, but all of the foreclosure filings will pay the fee. So does that?
Okay.
So that's right.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheid. And as Senator Scheid knows, this is a proposal, the concept that I've supported in the couple of different times that we've talked about it in detail in Commerce, and that last year and this year. But I have a similar concern, and I was thinking that it was going to be addressed by this point, but we haven't yet, I don't think. And I'm not even sure exactly what Senator Scheid's position is on it. But when we heard this in Commerce, one of the concerns that I heard from the banking industry, at least from my district, had to do with the question of why we have the Attorney General's office sort of intervening into a process that they're not normally involved with. We have a lot of arbitration mediation programs in the state, and we have the American Arbitration Association and a pretty streamlined process already in place for making an application for an arbitration and certain ability to approve people who have the training to be an arbitrator, and then to get that arbitration scheduled and set up. And the question came, you know, from the banks, why, although we understand this proposal came from the Attorney General's office, and I commend the Attorney General for her interest in this, there doesn't seem to be a real good rationale for adding a step to the administrative process involved in this. And the concern would be, isn't that just going to needlessly slow this down and add to the cost? So that's my concern. I was thinking that we were going to look at a way to try to address that concern.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that we'd be adding a step. In any case, the bill, the language requires the counseling, and some people would work out something at that stage with the lender. You know, there would be a certain number of people working things out there. There would be a certain number of people who had no hope of being able to renegotiate, whether it was, you know, a married couple who both lost their jobs or the main wage earner lost their job, whatever, and they have no ability at that point to renegotiate anything. They're still going to have to be offered the mediation. I mean, this bill would require that they had offered mediation, that everybody who's gone through the counseling could be told they have an opportunity for mediation. And that has to be done, and it's done just as a matter of fact with the foreclosure filing, you know, informing people of their rights. And I know that counselors would know about this process because they know they have to come first in the process of foreclosure if people choose to go to counseling. So if you're talking about, you know, it was promoted by someone who believes that we need to do something like this, and I'm not sure that the administration thinks we need to do something like this. So it came from the agency, if you will, that thinks we need it. And in terms of who is going to be conducting the mediations, I mean, it's going to be people who are schooled in mediation, and they're going to be, you know, the Attorney General's office is going to use those traditional sources with trained mediators, retired judges, that kind of person. So I don't know that it's adding any more bureaucracy or any other another step to the process.
Well, Mr. Chair, for example, on page 7, subdivision 2, beginning on line 7.5, when it talks about mediation proceeding notice, and then it goes on and lists a number of things that the Attorney General's office is going to do, which I'm assuming are all things that will require staff time to be able to do those things. And I guess I'm simply saying that we have a process already in place in the private sector that deals with getting this kind of thing set up, sending out notices. I mean, we simply have, for example, in other situations where you're required to go to arbitration, there's already organizations that have a list of those people, and it's handled without having to go back to an agency, have them kind of approve the whole process, and then and deal with the paperwork and send everything out for referrals. And that just, the concern that was expressed was that that was going to add additional cost in terms of more employees to be able to deal with that needed in the AG's office, and also that it may potentially slow down the process when there's perhaps a more direct route to go.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that you could use a private entity just without having some state agency responsible for the fee that's going to come in. I mean, I don't know who's going to determine which of those agencies are able to do this. There has to be a spot where this is administered. And I'm not saying, I don't think you can just leave people to their own devices. And how are those other entities going to be paid?
Well, Mr. Chair, we have the American Arbitration Association, and when you want to go through a mediation just for a regular old civil litigation type of case, you send in the paperwork there, and you send the fees there, and they handle distributing the fees, you know, to the attorney or the mediator, whoever it is that handles it. And so, you know, there's mediation also on the family law side. I mean, there are some systems already in place out there, I guess is all I'm saying.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, but the fee is being collected at the time the foreclosure is filed. The fee has to go someplace, and the bill calls for it to come to the state. It goes to the Attorney General's office, and they will administer the program. I don't know how the fee, unless you have some different scheme for the money or who pays the fee, would the parties just have to pay for it if they decide to go to mediation or not? I don't. This just seems to be to make it work much more smoothly, and people aren't out there waiting to get on somebody's schedule. I mean, this is going to be a system that has to be carefully structured and then organized so that it works smoothly. And I'm guessing that there will be mediators in different regions of the state, and they will be trained, and they'll know what they're working on. I think that's part of the Attorney General's plan, that there will be some kind of training involved to know who the parties, you know, how you get certain parties to the table, because in many cases, in many of these loans that are in foreclosure, the lender is not here in Minnesota. The mortgage may be in a package or in a portfolio on Wall Street someplace and owned by various entities, pension funds, other retirement funds, or just investment funds. And so they have, those entities have contracts with servicers here, and they'd be the people who would be, who now represent them in the foreclosure, would be representing those entities at a mediation. So you need to have some central place where this is all coordinated. That doesn't mean they wouldn't use those entities. I think they will. I think they'll have to, but I think it has to be, there has to be a centralization to the process.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I think you sort of answered my question, but what this does, the way I understand it, is the Attorney General is responsible for the program, but she has the freedom to contract that out to the American Arbitration Association or whatever entity she chooses to train and give authority to handle that portion of it. Is that
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, yes, that's right, and would have to. I don't think it can be handled by the staff that, you know, in the Attorney General's office. That's not the intent here. The intent is to have retired judges, other people who have expertise in real estate, and people perhaps with the American Arbitration Association or the Bureau of Mediation Services, administrative law judges, whatever. I think the Attorney General will be able to use all of those resources and would need to.
Senator Scheid, I'm just looking on page 14, up on line 14.6, it says, this amount is to be paid to the state treasury and credited to the Homestead Lender Mediation Act account in the Special Revenue Fund. Is that an account in the Attorney General's office? Is that why you keep saying it's going to the Attorney General, or is there something? Page 14, line.
No, Mr. Chairman, no. The account is described. It's new. It's described on page 20. So I see that it's referenced, from 14.3 to 14.8. But if you go to page 20, this bill establishes that account. And actually, it looks like it goes to the MHFA. Sorry.
Doesn't go to the AG then.
Right. I'm sorry.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Scheid, you have a couple of people who would like to testify, I guess.
Actually, I don't think I do, but they would
there
like
are,
to.
There are a couple of people.
Who don't love it quite as much as I do.
Kay Rucky and Mark Monticelli. You guys want to both come to the table at the same time? Guys is gender neutral, by the way, just so you all know.
Starts in grade school.
I literally felt screened in.
Starts in grade school.
Funny.
Oh,
funny.
I
learned
how to talk.
Who wants to go first?
I will go first. Please. I'm Kay Rucky. I'm the Martin County Recorder in Fairmont. I'm also president of the National Association of County Recorders and Election Officials and vice president of the Property Records Industry Association, which is a national standard-setting body that works with business and the real estate industry. Today I'm going to talk for the Minnesota County Recorders Association, and we are going to address Article 2, which, of course, is the funding mechanism. The concerns that the recorders have with that, of course, is the $125 fee. And in 2005, the Recorders Association, along with the Bar Association and The Title Association and the Realtors Association created the standard fee bill in Minnesota, which creates a statewide flat fee of $46 for every county and for every document throughout the state of Minnesota. This has become a national model for recording industries throughout the United States, and it is looked at in every state because of the consistency that we have with our national customers. One of the concerns that we have is transferring the state responsibility of a surcharge onto county government. $125 is added to only a couple types of documents. So you'll be recording every document for $46 except for two or three different types of documents, and they will be $171 for those documents. Already in the $46 fee, we have created, besides turnaround times, it's prescribed in law that we have a certain period of time in which we have to return documents, and we have covered that in a recording fee, along with $10.50 of every document goes into the state's general fund. What the recorders are concerned about is that county government can't handle any more mandates, particularly unfunded mandates. We have increased staff resources, processing time, the training time, the collecting time for just these specific documents. We are also incurring mailing costs because we have to notify our local customers and our national customers, and we have rejection times because if the document doesn't come in with the correct amount of money, we have issues with that, and that costs additional money. It also, once we have rejections of these recorded documents in our offices, it slows our recording time down, and basically it will affect these same documents that we want to collect $171 for. That will affect the debtor and the creditor on these. We also have to change our software to allow for these different document fees, and we'll have to do that when it comes into effect and then again when it sunsets again. These are additional costs to county government. We also have to do additional funding or accounting services for this additional fee. Then it also is the big concern that we have been a national model for our flat fee throughout Minnesota, and we do have some concerns of that. We do applaud the concerns that we do have counseling and some mediation programs. We understand that the effects of the foreclosure crisis, we see it every day in the documents that we get across our desks, but the Minnesota County Recorders Association strongly opposes this form of funding mechanism as another mandate to county government, which we cannot handle. Thank
you. So the $46 is increased by $125 here, and your objection is that you don't get any of the $125. Is that correct? Or?
No. Particularly, we really do not want to be a collection agency for any other agency. We have a national fee, a national model that we are very proud of. The $46 helps our customers out, and it helps our rejection time. So to have to add an additional workload on for collecting another fee just sets a precedent for anybody else to come into it and start attacking the recording fees.
Okay. Mr. Monticelli.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. I haven't been in the Capitol for about 12 years. I spent a great deal of time here lobbying on behalf of local government, and so I'm a recovering quasi-lobbyist. The 10-step program worked well.
Just say your name for the record, even though I already said it.
Mark Monticelli, St. Louis County Recorder, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill, the bill which attaches a fee to list pendants and notice of pendency, which are the pre-documents that come before closure. And just to give you a brief history of the state surcharges that have been applied to the recording fee, if I may. In 1992, the state added a $2 surcharge. Legal aid needed some money back then, some resources back then. Governor Carlson told state agencies that worked under him that they needed to come up with new sources of revenue or their budgets would be cut. So they added a $2 surcharge to the county recording fee, which applied to every document. Of that, $1.60 was retained by the state, went into the general fund, and 40 cents was retained by counties. After speaking with legal aid representatives, we asked them not to do this again, and they said they weren't going to do it. In 1993, they came back, and they increased the surcharge from $2 to $4 for every document recorded in a county recorder's office, which has nothing to do with any state project or process. The counties then received an extra dime. In 2001, the surcharge was increased to $4.50. In 2005, the county fees and recording standards for recording of real estate documents was passed, and the state surcharge was increased from $4.50 to $10.50. My office alone, in 2009, sent to the state for the recording fee on a real estate document, again, which had nothing to do with any state program, $441,815.50. For that $10.50 surcharge. Collectively, we paid to the states $724,041.50 for all other state surcharges, a charge on various programs that we have within the office. And a state of, and when we're facing a $1.2 billion budget problem, I have budget meetings tomorrow, we're looking at between a $4 and $8 million budget problem in St. Louis County alone. Those are significant dollars that we could use locally. There are no shortages of ideas to add a fee or a surcharge. Lead abatement people have requested some. Housing authorities have requested some. And nobody in this room, I think, can argue with the importance of the foreclosure program and keeping people in their homes and what this has done to our economy. But we do have a problem with the non-uniformity fees that we work so hard to develop, along with the local, with Minnesota Bar Association, the Minnesota Land Title Association, and the realtors. Standard fees. We went away from a per-page document charge, and right now, as we speak, there are thousands and thousands of people around the county, around the state, around the country, counting pages to a document to figure out what the recording fee is. And if the recording fee is wrong, if there's 200 pages and they counted 95, it gets rejected. It costs the industry about on average of $40 to $50 for every document in rejection. So we're very proactive. Mortgage fraud and land fraud is a huge problem in the United States. And if I may, I would like to I'd like to just take off my Minnesota County Recorders Association hat and testify as the former president of the Property Records Industry Association. I've worked with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I've worked with major lenders in this country. I work with law enforcement, the FBI, the Officer Inspector General, the Housing and Urban Development on mortgage fraud and land fraud. These issues are very significant in our country. And as the senator said, dilapidated housing within a particular jurisdiction has a detriment to that particular area. But adding on the surcharge to a recording fee that we work so hard to streamline county government at the local level in cooperation with the state for a cause like this, I think is being a little short-sighted, even though that the project is very, very important. Mediation services already occur in all 87 counties. In St. Louis County, mediation services are handled by Lutheran Social Services. In mediation counseling, they not only get counseling for the mortgage and align them with the creditor to deal with it, but when you're talking about mortgage foreclosures, you also have to consider the underlying debt. Anybody that may be underwater in their mortgage usually has credit problems, credit cards behind on their utility payments, those types of things. And that's why these agencies are so important. And in the northern half of the county, St. Louis County, it's handled by the Arrowhead Economic Agency. Lutheran Social Services has mediation services in three quarters of the counties within Minnesota, and in every other county, they're covered by other independent agencies. So do we really need to duplicate a program when the state is really looking at significant budget problems in these difficult times? I also like to make the committee aware of the fact that Congress has two bills that are introduced, Senate File 2912 and House File 4635, called the Foreclosure Mandatory Mediation of Act of 2010 that has been introduced. This calls for one-time mediation at the expense of the mortgagee or the lender. Now, the caveat here is it applies to every federal loan and any which would be Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, or any loan held by the Mortgage Electronic Registration System or MERS, in which they file the document with them as nominee of record. So there already is legislation put forward. But the point I want to make here is, you know, this, I don't have to tell you what the budget situation is for the following biennium and how are we going to deal with that. Is the answer to that creating a larger state agency? I'm not so sure. But in any case, we oppose this, going back to my Minnesota County Recorder's hat, because it takes away from the uniformity of the fee that we work so hard to develop in the state of Minnesota. And we're very unique here in the state of Minnesota. Not only do we have a standardized fee that's not based on per documents, but we also, part of that legislation, also created state standards in which we have to have documents in and out at a certain period of time. By pursuant to state statute, we are the only state that has that, and it's working well. Now, just to start imposing various fees onto various documents, and there are going to be more people coming down the pike with very worthy causes, that's why we're here to oppose it. We worked hard, and we want to keep our fees uniform, regardless of the situation.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I suspect that these people have a little more work to do with abandoned homes where the property taxes are not being paid, where titles are in question or in kind of a limbo. I know they have additional work because of the foreclosure situation. $125 on two documents. It's a notice of pendency for a notice of foreclosure by advertisement. That's how most of the foreclosures occur. You've all seen the advertisements in your local paper. That's foreclosure by advertisement. That's how most of the foreclosures occur in Minnesota. There's also a notice that comes when it's a foreclosure by action, and those are far fewer. Those, as I read the bill, are the only places. Pretty clear foreclosure. It grabs your eye, and I think that the form probably, I haven't seen one specifically, but I'm sure it probably says what the filing is. And you just add $125 and you send it to the state. And I know that I understand the uniform fee. That's subject to change, I suppose, every time we meet. And that may go up, in which case software will have to change as well. You know, so I understand uniformity. This is for not even a 2-year period. I think this sunsets December 31st, 2012. This is what's happening in our neighborhoods and our communities is destroying actually the fabric of those communities. It's having a devastating effect on certain neighborhoods more than others. And it's not peculiar just to Senator Scheid's two communities that she represents or Senator Higgins represents in the north side of Minneapolis. It also is occurring in some of the smaller towns around the state. So what we, you know, and somebody said to me at a town meeting a couple years ago, well, why are you working on this foreclosure thing? If people got themselves into debt, that's their problem. Well, let me tell you about Representative Hillstrom's story. She lives in a house that probably 4 years ago was worth valued by the assessor. Its market value is about $200,000. And her house isn't as big as the house right kind of behind her. She lives on a corner. That house right behind her, more square footage, new siding, new windows, bigger yard, way bigger yard. Just sold for $56,000 less than a year ago. Foreclosure's coming to a house next door to you. It has an impact on the value of your home. We have seen it in our neighborhood. I assume most of you have seen it as well. And it's having an effect on cities and counties. It's having an impact on our state. We were in the forefront of what we were doing dealing with predatory loans and the counseling. And by the way, I don't think it's mediation services that are being offered. It's counseling that is being offered all over the state. And we did that 2 years ago. And that's working to some degree. But the counselors will tell you, there are certain lenders you can't get to the table. You don't know who they are. And the counselors can't require them to be there to negotiate. We need the impact of having a retired judge or a mediator with some authority, with the state law behind them, to pull people to the table, whether it's by telephone or sitting in the room with them, with the homeowner, to get down to the nuts and bolts of what can be worked out and how people, you know. And I just think, frankly, that we're saving some of these lenders, some of these funds from themselves. They seem to think that just getting rid of something is, they take the easy way out. We're actually going to save them money. If you have somebody, if you have a house sitting vacant on my street for a year and a half or 2 years, it's doing nothing but taking money and resources to make sure, and it's not dilapidated. You know, none of the homes I'm speaking of are dilapidated. They're just nobody there. And so that safety and other issues come into play, and as well as vandalism. We haven't had that problem yet because we're very watchful in our neighborhood, but we're all very concerned. And I'm sure you have neighborhoods like that yourself. So we need the, I think, the arm of the state government to say, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We want people coming to the table and talk about how we're going to save homes for homeowners in our neighborhoods and our communities. And what's happened is we've fallen behind a number of other states. We were leading for a while, but now a number of states, and in fact the court in Florida, has ordered mediation. And that's happening around the country, where you just can't have this kind of devastation going on without somebody at some level saying, this has to stop. We have to try to keep people in their homes. Paying something reasonable is better than no one paying anything. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's the tax write-off that they want to preserve for the loss. That's pretty twisted. I think what we want is for our neighborhoods and our communities to keep people living there and try to save some of these homes, and I'm sure we will save many. Can't give you a specific number, but I know we will save many, and that's the goal of this, and somehow it has to be paid for, and we could argue all, you know, from now till Sunday about how it should be paid for. This seems to be pretty straightforward. You send in a notice of foreclosure, that initial notice, you send $125 with it, and the county knows when they get that, they know where that it comes to the state, and it's going to try to help save that homeowner in that home.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would just go back to follow up on what Senator Scheid said, is that my objection to this, and I think the county testifiers I've heard objection to this, is not with the policy of having mediation and the need for mediation. It's with the process, the approach that's being used in this particular circumstance. And I guess I'd point out that the $120, the bill does not appear to contemplate that that's going to pay for the mediation. It looks as though that's just simply money going to the Attorney General's office to process the paperwork, as opposed to, and that because it specifically says on line 8.7, for example, the mediator has to disclose the fees to be charged or a rate schedule of fees for the mediation proceeding. And then there's another part on 8.33 that it says the Attorney General may appoint and arrange for the compensation of mediators who are qualified persons experienced in finance or negotiation, but it doesn't say that the money is going to be used out of this bill to pay for those mediators. Unless I'm missing something.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 on page 20, Section 4 of Article 2, so it's on page 20, the second to the last page of the bill. And it goes to the MHFA, first of all, and I was mistaken in the beginning. And it says that money in that account may only be used to pay for the compensation of mediators, for reasonable reimbursement for staff and other administrative costs, and I think they foresee about one or two people needed to help coordinate this. And the money will only go as far as the money will go. This, if it's not paid for by this, it's not paid for. It's not going to happen. So this is for those candidates, for realistic candidates for mediation. And I understand it's going to be paid for by everybody who's foreclosing, and not all of them will be participating in mediation. I understand that, but we tried to make it as fair as we could, understanding that every foreclosed home in every neighborhood and every community is a serious loss and a serious issue before us right now. And this law does sunset at the end of 2012.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Now, just so I understand the county's position, it's not the $125. It's the $125 is that you don't get any of it.
No. Mr. Chairman, our position is we fully agree with Article A of the bill. We have a problem with the mechanism to fund it. And, you know, I did state that my office sent $441,000 in 2009 for state surcharges. Perhaps the money can be taken out of there. I realize it leaves a hole in the budget, but is adding another fee on, we keep adding fees, we keep adding surcharges, we keep building and building. And we fully realize the foreclosure problem and agree with that, but is this the best mechanism to do that, given the fact that we work so hard to streamline service delivery, and there are a lot of people out there that would like to attach a fee onto the recording fee, and where do we end? As I mentioned, lead abatement people, housing programs, you name it, anything that has any ancillary tie to the recording function, there are people that would like to collect a fee, so that's why we're here.
Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, may I also add a comment? Recently, our county, Martin County, had to come up with some unique funding issues for our county offices. We're during a department head meeting, we're going back and looking at what we have to do to cut in our offices. So any further work, any additional work, we can't handle it in our offices because we're not replacing staff anymore. We have no extra funding in our budgets when we're cutting pens and pencils and things like that. We have no extra money in our budgets to pick up these extra costs. We understand the foreclosure crisis because we live it every day. We see it in our communities, and we see it on our desks, and we see all this paper, but we also have to function as an office. And with added work and being taxed for this, we can't handle any more of that. And that's the other issue on this.
Okay. Is anybody else who would like to say something for or against the bill? Okay, can you two step out so somebody else can step up? Thank you for your testimony. Say your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers. I'm also speaking on behalf, or I should say, up on the issues as far as some of the housing counselors and also for the consumers. The issues I know here are limited to the financial issues and understanding, first of all, that the consumers who are going through these foreclosure counseling are not charged as far as for the counseling itself. However, it has not been effective just because the counselors are not able to force the proper people to the table, as Senator Scheid had said. And that is why you do need the Attorney General's office involved, and you need people with financial ability who understand the legal issues and the financial issues. As far as who pays for it, from a consumer standpoint, I think the $125, and I didn't see it addressed here in the bill, a consumer going through foreclosure, that's a small amount to pay for saving their home. And you can even ask for it from the consumer. I think they'd be willing to pay if there was a chance to save their home because counseling is ineffective. And I think that as far as recovering it from a person, the state has various mechanisms to recover money owed to the state, which can all work, and even the court systems has it. And I think this is a cheaper method to go through mediation than the normal process where a consumer is notified that they're going through foreclosure, they have so much to redeem, they have all these attorney fees attached onto it from the lender's side of it anyway, and they need a way to be able to negotiate and an effective negotiator. And this is why that little bit of money, I think, would go a long way that they'd be willing to pay rather than ending up in court and having to pay their own attorney fees anyway or just lose the property. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee then? Anybody else have anything to say? Okay. Anybody like to move the bill? Senator Kelash. Move that Senate File 2170 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any more discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. All opposed? Looks like the motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
Senator Shy, do you have another bill?
Mr. Chairman.
This works
Mr.
out a little bit better. Senate File 1905.
Chairman, Senate File 1905. And I believe there's an amendment. I had an amendment, but I think that you had indicated we really should stick to the way we had the bill out of here last year. And I think you have an amendment, perhaps that Senator Koch is going to offer, that is an improvement on that study that, well, we actually called for an application. It was development of a uniform application. But this is a much broader amendment calling for a study of the topic, which the original bill contained a measure to increase the small employer group from 50 to 100. And I was going to come in and ask you today to raise that to 75, and I do have some people who would like to testify on the need for that, and then perhaps you discuss an amendment.
Would you like to have the testifiers up first?
Mr. Chairman, please.
Okay. Who wants to testify here? Ms. Mosley and Ms. Hoppe?
Who's going first?
Who wants to go first?
I will. I'm Joy Mosley, owner of Biotest Laboratories Incorporated. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Shide. As the owner of a small business who participated in the small group employer pool until the number of employees reached 50, we had a predictable annual increase in our insurance premiums. In 2008, when we reached 50 employees and went beyond that, we were no longer within the definition of small group employer. During that year, we had a single employee who had a major medical need that drove the expenses up over $1.5 million. At the end of the year, we received a renewal estimate at a 75% increase in premium. That was after being denied a quote from any other provider. After a significant amount of negotiation, we ended with a 42% increase in our premium. Today, we still believe that we are and see that we are an employer too small to self-insure and are vulnerable to unpredictable increases at the end of the year that can be brought about by a single person who has a special medical need. We employ individuals who are very technical, and we employ individuals who are not as technical. We currently have 79 employees. And so we are asking that in this time of consideration of how we can control health care costs, this doesn't control health care costs. It allows us to participate in the pool. It allows us to continue to participate to provide a quality health care plan for our employees, which we see as a critical function that employers provide at this time in our lives with the role that small employers pay for providing medical care.
So when you passed the 50 threshold, things kind of went out of whack for you.
Yes, that year we happened to have that one employee who had a special need, and his health care needs did go over $1.5 million. So we're vulnerable to that, and there is no cap, as would be provided if we were able to participate in the small group employer pool. So our perspective is that we would not have to create a system. We wouldn't have to change a system. We could just change the definition of small group employer and allow more companies to continue to participate, just spread the risk.
Okay.
I'm Rebecca Hoppe, Manager of Corporate Administration at BioTest Laboratories. As Ms. Mosley has just pointed out, we are a small company, 79 employees. We have enjoyed some success over the last several years, and so we have increased over the 50 employee demarcation, if you will, between the small group and the large group for insurance purposes. There was a study that was done by the Kaiser Foundation last year that stated that overall insurance premiums have increased to employers in the United States 131%. And this has had a devastating impact, obviously, on small employers, most especially in the economy we now find ourselves in. This has placed tremendous hardship on employers. This same study found that 8% of the small employers surveyed had no choice but to drop their insurance coverage. At this point in time, a full 60% of our employee population, and these are members of our community, 60% are either single heads of household, or are the sole source for health insurance for their families because of unemployment of a spouse. This is significant to BioTest Laboratories. BioTest Laboratories is committed to a single objective that has three components. One is to provide continued employment for our employees, the members of our community, to provide health benefits for these members. And again, 60% of our employee population depends on the coverage provided by BioTest Laboratories, and to provide quality services to our clients. Our clients are in the medical community. We serve medical device manufacturers with a variety of services, and so we are indirectly providing services to everyone in our community. The issue we've seen is predictability of premiums. In the small group plan, small employers are protected by the regulations afforded by the plan. Once we cross the 50-employee threshold, there is no longer a protection. Premiums can increase dramatically at any level, making budgeting for a small employer very challenging. And at this point, we are supporting the language increasing the definition of small employer to 1 to 100 employees.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman.
I keep hearing these numbers, 75 and 100.
Chairman.
But I'm trying to figure out if I'm missing something in your bill.
Mr. Chairman, no, I told you I would have I had originally an amendment.
Okay.
That would have taken that up to 75. The original bill before what you have in your hand, the first section was the increase to 100, from 50 up to 100, so it would be 2 to 100.
I don't see that either.
No, Mr. Chairman, that was the original bill last year.
Oh,
was the original bill.
She hasn't offered it.
And that was taken out.
Wait, no. Okay, so now the bill, though, I got in front of me says, the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with the Commissioner of Health, Employers, and Health Plans, shall develop and recommend to the legislature a uniform health coverage application form for consideration for adoption by the 2010 legislature, the form required for use in the state applying for coverage for small employee market. And I don't see any, numbers, like 100 or 75.
Chairman, that was removed from the bill last year. That section was taken out of the bill.
Do I have?
So
am I missing some work? Am I supposed to be looking at this?
And I don't even know if I have an original copy. I have an amendment to add that section back in, and it takes the number to 75. The bill last year took it to 100. It has become apparent, and I think that you may have talked to a number of people that find that problematic. Apparently, that make us the only state to go above the 50. The federal requirement is apparently the small employers defined up to 50. And people at the Department of Commerce and others have told me that we need to see some actuarial evidence of what this would do to all of those people who are currently in that small employer pool. So I think that Senator Koch has an amendment to address that aspect. I am not at this point offering the 50. I don't plan to offer it. I wish I could, but I'm not. And Senator Koch's amendment.
Senator Koch, why don't you explain what your amendment will do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scheid, thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you to the folks from BioTest for bringing this to our attention. I think it's a very important issue. My concern would just be exactly what you said. The Department of Commerce brought some concerns regarding what this will do to the existing small group and potentially the larger groups. It definitely, I think, would reduce and add some predictability for those companies that are 51 to 100. But I'd like a work group. And that's what this my proposed amendment does, a work group with all the players involved through the Department of Commerce that will look at all the potential upside and downside to changing this language. I include in here some insurance folks. I include the Chamber of Commerce, the NFIB, small business people, and a little bigger business people. And I'd like them to have the discussion and then come forward with some recommendations. And so that's what my amendment would do.
So is this thing here the amendment, or are
we Well, waiting? I would defer to staff on that, Carlin.
Mr. Chair and committee, I got down to my office, and I had an amendment sitting there, and I had about 2 minutes to get to committee. And Senator Rest has a very specific checklist for any work groups, task forces. I hadn't even looked at it, so I think we should – I will work on the language and cap – help me out here.
So if Senator Scheid, is it okay if we lay this over till Wednesday and so we can get this amendment done in accordance with whatever the council needs to do here? So, I mean, I could add this thing on, but I'm not – is it ready for prime time? Or?
Mr. Chair, there are just a couple areas. One place it's called a work group. One place it's called a task force. So just clearing that up, and then there are a couple of things that Senator Rest requires in her – task force work group things, and all the other representatives and
so Senator Koch and Senator Scheid, you've both agreed that you want to do something like this. You want it right
Mr.
now,
Chairman.
Or is it okay if we wait?
Mr. Chairman, no, I think you should wait until you've been able to make the language work according to the checklist. My question is, I assume it will have to go to the state and local committee if you meet the requirements, then maybe we won't have to. And
yes,
I would urge you to do it that way.
Yeah, I will show it to the other Senate counsel, Tom Bodern, for him to look at, and maybe he can run it by Senator Russ, and then we can.
Okay.
I have absolutely no quarrel with that. Generally go back to policy committees? Because we're in the finance committee, so we don't generally go back to policy committees, I don't think. But
Mr. Chair, members, no, and that's why the state and local has a checklist for some working groups. And typically, if you can draft bill language or amendment language in this case so that it meets those requirements, Senator Rest, in looking at it, will often waive their referral request. So that will be our goal in the next couple of days to fix that. So that on Wednesday, we'll bring this bill up and bring a corrected whatever amendment to Senate File 1905.
Okay. So does anybody, since we're going to do this, does anybody else feel the need to testify? Okay. All right. Then Senator Koch moves that Senate File 1905 be laid on the table for further work on Wednesday. Okay, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Okay. Thank you to the committee for all your time.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Senator Scheid. Senator Saltzman.
It's really exciting. I love the blue stripe. The blue stripe is very cute.
Senator Saltzman, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be here, and I am here today with Senate File 2751, which is an at-risk business report and fast action economic response team proposal.
I'm happy you said that clearly this time, because the first time I can't say what I heard.
It's a clear thing. So, you should have the first engrossment before you. And this bill came to me in reviewing some of the work we've been doing with the state of Wisconsin, trying to work with them on similar language regarding our angel investor credit bills so that we are able to work with our neighboring state. It's important that we work as a region. Obviously, we compete with them, but it's important that we be a stronger region trying to find policies that bring people to the upper Midwest. Looking at this particular bill that I saw, it reflected that they are trying to find ways to address the fact that when a business is either considering moving outside the state or coming to the state, that there be an immediate team available to work with them. And so this bill creates a fast action economic response team that would contact and work with businesses that are identified as being at risk for relocating or expanding outside the state, or prospects for expansion or relocation within the state. And certainly this bill is not in response to the fact that we aren't doing this. It's perhaps could we do it better. And it's not an issue for just the department. It's how can we work as a team with public and private sectors to be able to have a larger welcome mat out for our businesses. Now, this morning I met with a major business in my community. And this particular CEO is working on a larger business group on an economic development report for Minnesota. And the one comment was made is that as they're looking across the country, what we're hearing is that our state is probably toward the end. Thank you very much. It's probably toward the bottom.
I was going to tell you to do that, too. You know.
Thank you. It's probably toward the bottom of the list when it comes to having a really aggressive economic development plan in place. When this bill was heard in our Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, as some of you heard Mr. Ward talk about his business, RJA Dispersions, which was located in the East Metro area, and even during the economic downturn, as many businesses were closing, they were seeing an increase in their sales and needed to expand. And they looked around the East Metro area. I know they worked with Deed and they, you know, were responsive, but when it came time to finding a new location, they moved to Hudson. And that was because of some of the tools that they had, but they also made the comment that they just felt really, really welcome there. So in this legislation, one thing we need to know from the department is what kind of economic tools would be helpful in terms of, keeping businesses here, and what are we doing to be really much more aggressive when businesses are considering are considering relocating to Minnesota. And I do want to note that, obviously, we can't just wait until we hear business is leaving. We have to look at our overall business climate, and certainly our tax climate is something we can have a discussion about, but what are we doing to make businesses that are here feel really welcome here? And that was something else that was brought up today in this meeting, was the fact that, you know, governors from other states are coming and visiting our businesses and, you know, giving them the sales pitch. We need to make sure that our businesses that are here know that we don't take them for granted. What are their needs? Not just within, you know, our economic, you know, policies, but in terms of their needs, in terms of their workforce. So I guess this is a good start so that we have a better idea of what are the tools that the department believes that it needs. And again, this is not directed to any specific department or commissioner or governor. We all need to do a better job in this area, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. I like this fast action economic response team. How do they find out about the business? Do you know, or is it?
Well, that, Mr. Chair, is a very good question, in that it would probably be something that we need to keep our feelers out, in that if we develop a public-private partnership, a lot of times I have heard over the past year as I've worked on some of these bills, you know, you hear about these things through the rumor mill. And so working not just as a public sector, but how do we create a public-private sector team that brings in our businesses? When I went to Atlanta last year with the chambers from Minneapolis and St. Paul, there were about 80 people that went down to Atlanta, 60 or 80. It was a couple bus fulls. And we listened to the city fathers from Atlanta talking about what they do for the city and how they identify every year they sit down and they identify the businesses that they want to bring to Atlanta and Georgia. And they work with their state to really go out and bring them into town and talk with them and really sell the state and sell the city. And I think we do that, but we could do a much, much better job, because Minnesota, we have a wonderful track record here. But in terms of our trend lines, we need to do a better job. And it's not just the metro area, as you know, Mr. Chair. We need to do this statewide, because we have such potential in some of our, you know, outstate areas. And we have folks who are in, like, you know, people in our state are hardworking, they're skilled. We have to sell that to the rest of the world.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Salzman, I agree with you. Since I've been here, the part that I see has more to do with tourism, because I sit on the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, and I see that Minnesota, that used to really be the leader regionally for promoting tourism and thought of as a destination location for fishing and hunting and just outdoor recreation, is really losing out, falling behind compared to, say, for example, Wisconsin, because we're not marketing ourselves, and every year we just cut some more out of marketing. But this isn't directed specifically to marketing. This is more looking at what we can do kind of as a whole, it looks like, to try to either bring or keep businesses in our state. But the question I have is, doesn't this kind of go to the core of what DEET is supposed to be doing right now? And what are they doing about this? Are they doing anything?
Well, on that point, I know the department is here today, and I wanted to clarify that this is not about pointing a finger at what someone isn't doing well. But we need to know what are the resources that they need. Because I think that at times we hear from people, well, we'd like to be able to do that, or we don't have a budget for that, or we don't have staff assigned to that area. And so I know that they are working on this, and they are working with other nonprofit groups within the state on economic development. But the question is, as I repeatedly hear, is that, and this is from our business community, is we're not doing enough. And that we need to have better leadership. When you consider Rudy Perpich, and I was not serving in the legislature during that time, but people talk about, he had a number of different ideas, and people look back, and sometimes they sort of chuckled about them, but he would go wherever he needed to go to bring jobs to Minnesota. And so what are we doing in this area that we know as a legislature for us to do our job? what are things that the department believes that it, you know, not only thinks it wants, but really, really needs to be much more effective? What kind of other policies are there? So some of this is probably, you know, they're economic development tools, but at the same time, it's what else can we be doing to just have a stronger recruitment team?
Back the Mall of America was Rudy Perpich's, so you want to talk about bringing people into the state, you know, that was his. Mr. Loftus, did you want to respond to sure. Senator Olson's question here? Or, I think it was kind of directed toward you guys. But.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm the Director of Business and Community Development at DEED. We do support, we've had conversations with Senator Saltzman, we do support the bill because, and I don't mind having fingers pointed at us because we want to do a better job. Kind of continuous improvement in economic development is something we should all be responsible for, and this puts us with the legislature in trying to figure out ways to do it better. And to Senator Olson's specific question, we have an extensive program of trade shows we go to every year. We probably have a half dozen trade shows, from the biotech show to the wind energy show to other trade shows that are in our industries. We have visits of by our staff. We have a team of 10 economic development staff who visit with companies in their regions. We have 6 located in offices outside St. Paul and 4 including the director located in St. Paul. In fact, tomorrow they're hosting a European company that's looking at several facilities in the state all around renewable energy, a major project that would be significant if it happened. So we are, I think part of the point of this legislation is to ask us to highlight for you what it is that we do. We haven't really done that for a while and say how, that's where we're at now with our resources. What more could we do? What should we be doing? And I hope you all believe that I want to have the resources to be as outstanding as we can on that, Mr. Chairman.
To that point, then, we're in a finance division here, and it looks to me like this is something that Senator Metzen alludes to all the time when he's in his we don't need to give you extra money for you to be able to do this mode. And this looks like one of those kind of bills where you can handle internally in the department.
That's right, Mr. Chairman. We don't need any money for this, but I would have to say that the outcome of the recommendations we might identify might be further resources that would be aimed at the next biennium. So, okay. Yeah, absolutely. To do this, we don't need any new money.
Okay. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, I'm Mike. Senator Olson, I think that this is all under what DEED should be doing now. And my question, I guess, is the outcome sounds like we're going to need more money. And one of the things that I'm missing is estate planning process. What businesses are we? I'm going back to the start of the session when we went to One Minnesota and we were talking about innovation, and that comes from the strengths that we already have. And I'm not sure if this is really addressing not just going out and bringing businesses in, but building the strengths that Minnesota has currently with this. So can you just go a little more into that?
You know, on that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, you are right in many respects. There's a number of bills that are floating around the legislature this session that have to do with small business and larger business. And I will go to the fact that I don't believe, and most others do not believe, that the state really has a comprehensive long-term economic development plan. We have some programs in place. But when you look at what Ohio is doing, what some of the other states in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Kansas, they have created with leadership a longer-term plan that would say, you know, in year 2 we want to meet these goals, in year 3 and year 4. So what we've done, in fact, there was a lot of discussion in the last 2 years with some of the national organizations that I had worked with Representative Mahoney in the House, is we tried to find out is there a role for the legislature? You know, we are not the administration, but what can we do in terms of policy? And so they talked about some of the bills that we should be passing that are sort of the low-hanging fruit that we absolutely have to, and that's the angel investor credit and some of these other policies, some things like this to talk about immediately if we have businesses that are leaving the state, what are we doing right now? That also goes to another bill that is moving through the legislature that calls for a new authority that brings together the public, private, and academic sector to really create a stronger economic development plan for the state that is not dependent on one administration to the next, but is a longer-term vision and really brings in the people who are in the front line of this. What is our research university doing? What are its needs? How are we passing the baton between the research sector to, you know, the private sector? What do we need in terms of public policy to make that happen? And that's really where sort of the angel investor credit has been identified. But we need to look at what are those sectors that are the most promising and having a very specific plan, because innovation, as we heard, takes a plan. It just doesn't happen. So this is sort of setting the stage of these are pieces of that that could fall under that, but most would say that we don't have the kind of comprehensive plan that we need. And that comes from leadership. And whomever our governor is, in 2011, this is something that absolutely needs to be addressed. And I think that some of the bills that are out there this session are sort of setting the table so that discussion is ready to go and looking at some of those pieces.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I absolutely agree with what you said about the need for long-range planning in almost anything you're talking about. I don't know how you expect to get to an end result if you don't really have a roadmap for where you're going. But the question that I have, the bigger kind of the $24 million question or whatever that we always argue about on different sides of the aisle, really kind of has to do with, you know, what are the most important things to fund in terms of economic development? How do you best get there? And so, for example, you can have tax credits and tax incentives. And I doubt very much if you ask the people who would be the beneficiaries of those things whether it makes a difference to them or not that those things are in place, that they're going to disagree. Because everybody likes to have tax benefits that, you know, I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't like to have a tax benefit if they can. On the other hand, we go and we hear from experts about what attract business to a state, and they talk about things workforce and quality of life related. And so if you don't have a well-educated workforce because you're not putting enough money into education, or if you're losing your young people to other states because the cost of our higher education system is too high, or our roads aren't taken care of, et cetera, then that's not good for attracting business either. And it doesn't seem fair that you would say to business, we're going to give you the tax breaks, but everyone else is going to pay for it for these things that you also need and rely on to have your businesses work. So how do you address finding the right balance and make sure that what you're doing is fair to the population as a whole and is really effective and not just I'd like to have that tax break? You know what I mean?
I guess, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it would be is that that's why I think that when you look at creating a plan like that, you have a really broad group of stakeholders at the table talking about it so that it's not just, you know, this plan is coming from this group, but that you have really a balanced group that looks at it and that was in the recommendations from the Science and Technology Working Group that, you know, that came out. I'm not sure if we've talked about it in this committee yet, but really talked about the importance of a workforce, the role of our universities, the role of our K-12 system, and all of those pieces that are very, very important that you have to make investments in all of those areas. And I think that one of the questions that has come up the most about tax credits is, In tech-based economic development, the way these ideas take longer to be developed, when they produce, they do amazing things, but the need for capital to get them to that next stage is probably greater than some of the other, sectors that we've seen. Mr. Like, you know, perhaps you have some, you know, other examples of that. It's that it's sort of a new economic development plan that DEED has worked with, and Mr. Loftus is very familiar with, It has different needs. And our state has been very successful in these areas, and we're not quite sure why. It was because there wasn't a lot of competition because we were the first. But now that all these other states are coming into this area, there's a greater competition for funds. So that's been I hope that's addressed your issue of trying to find balance of we have limited dollars and wanting to make sure that where they do go, we get the most bang for the buck. So I appreciate your comment.
Mr. Loftus.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I would also add that one approach that we take is to look at every business in some ways as a unique entity with its own needs. They are a unique customer. And in some cases, the early investment tax credit will be helpful to them. In some cases, information about workforce is critical because they don't know how to access people in a certain niche. Or in some cases, it's access to qualified or a customized training program. So it's difficult for me to say today, or I think going forward, we need to be candid that to say that once we have a program with X million here and X million here and 200,000 here, that we'll have the perfect program. It's a continuing work in progress as the economy changes, as our competition changes in other states. Because I'm proud of it, I have to tell you about the success of our project in Faribault, Sage Electrochromics, project that we've been working on for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. We have in that project, we have Minnesota Investment Fund, which you provide to us. We have Job Skills Partnership dollars. We have the basic Job Z and the extension which the legislature authorized last session. We have collaboration with local government, with the utility. Every possible tool we can provide, given a small toolkit with small tools in that kit, we have provided. And we won that project over upstate New York. So mm-hmm. I think you should all be proud of that. Those tools you provided to us, we try to use as well as we can.
Didn't they just get $100 million from the feds, too?
Well, Mr. Chairman, they did in some tax credits, and they also got a loan guarantee of about $73 million, for which they have to raise $17 million in credit. So it's maybe not the best loan guarantee anybody ever got. So the investment funding money we can provide is real dollars, real cash to help pay for some of their equipment. So very creative, and we've got to be creative, too, in all of these, as we assemble these tools. So,
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, Senator Olson, recently I've heard of about four or five international companies that are moving to the state, and they aren't concerned about our tax burden at all. Our taxes are a bargain compared to where they're usually going. So what they're more concerned of is the quality of the workforce, the quality of life, and the ability to come here and grow their businesses in a very, I would say, more of a European lifestyle than a lot of the rest of the country has to offer because of our focus on arts and all the activities that we offer these companies. So that's one of those things that I think that the tax cut things aren't getting to. We're an attractive place because of the quality that we've built over the years and the lifestyles and infrastructure. So,
they really like the Vikings, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Well,
just
Mr. Chair,
fun. Senator Olson.
I just have to say this. You know, if it's ever possible to design a perfect program where the money is only being used for the purpose you want, that would be wonderful. But so often what happens, for example, with Job Z, is if you've got various astute businesses moving from one county to another, taking advantage of tax credits for as long as they last, and then not contributing what everyone else is having to contribute to the help pay for the schools that are educating the workers in those businesses, et cetera. And I worry about that with the angel investor credits. I mean, you have insurance companies with money that they'd like to invest because they make a profit making those investments. And some of those investments are a bit riskier, but the ones that are riskier tend to be the most profitable. And now we're going to give them a tax break so that they don't have to pay as much taxes on those investments and things that could turn out to be very profitable for them. I mean, if they had to pay it back, I'd feel a little better about it. But I do have a problem with taxpayers as a whole underwriting those kinds of things that I'm not 100% sure aren't just helping their bottom line as opposed to what I know is your goal, which is providing the jobs and helping the economy as a whole.
Senator Salzman.
Well, to just make a note, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson, is that the Angel Investor Credit is a credit to the investor. So the company never sees it, and it's leveraged. So that's different than I think you're referring to the Capco bill, which is the insurance pool. But the Angel Investor is rewarding investors who make an investment in a company and take a risk. So we're trying to incentivize individuals to let go of their money and invest in these companies in Minnesota. So there's Ebbies, but the Capco, I hear your concerns, and we certainly want to keep working on that bill so people are comfortable with it. Again, is there a way to incentivize? Because these are riskier businesses, and at what point, you know, how much more do we have to pay to encourage people to take a risk in these kinds of companies? I think that's the balance there, because they are making investments, but let's try to keep those investments here in Minnesota, perhaps. So I hear you on that one.
Okay. Let's face it, Senator Salzman, what you want to do is make sure that we don't lose somebody to somebody to another state and try and get more people to come here. So
that is right, Mr.
Senator,
Chair.
Senator Keel, do you want to comment, Senator Koch, or can I make a motion here?
I was just going to move the bill, Mr. Chair. Laying it over for possible inclusion?
Yes, we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion. So Senator Koch moves that Senate File 2751 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion's adopted. Senator Koch, thank you, Senator Salzman.
Well, it's great to be here, Senator Tomasoni.
Pleasure is always ours. Senator Koch, Senate File 3206.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 3206 does a little bit of expansion on the use of the Minnesota Investment Fund, and also and actually expanding it to help smaller businesses is the plan here with this. I should note that there's no additional cost to what we're proposing here. It's using existing funds. And the second piece is the construction mitigation grants. As you recall, that was Senator Patricia Torres-Ray had that, and it was mitigation efforts to include the cost of producing signage and financing to help smaller businesses. In the language, we had said only up to 5 projects. Deed was able to get 19, I believe, responses. 13. Like
19
I'm sorry.
Responses.
19 responses, but they could actually help 13 projects with existing funds, and so they're looking to remove the up to 5 language to help all 13 of those projects.
Okay.
With existing funds.
Mr. Isaacson?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bob Isaacson. I'm Director of Business Finance Office for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Just a couple of thoughts on this.
Are you related to any of the Isaacsons from the Iron Range?
I am not, sir.
Okay.
Just say yes.
Sure.
You're getting the hang of this, though.
Me too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Isaacson. Go ahead.
Maybe some in Canada. Who
yeah.
knows?
that doesn't work.
A couple of thoughts on the provisions here. The first provisions regarding the Minnesota Investment Fund is, as you know, the Minnesota Investment Fund is a program that we provide grants to local governments, which they then loan to businesses for expansion and equipment and other types of gap financing purposes. Federal government allows community development block grant funds that are funneled through Minnesota Investment Fund and portion go through the Minnesota Investment Fund to be used for technical assistance. And what we would like to do, have the authority to do, is use some of those dollars that are federally funded to provide assistance to small businesses. In this economy, small businesses are really fueling so much economic growth, and we want to provide some of these federal dollars to help help them continue growing through technical assistance, which includes counseling, marketing assistance, business operational assistance, and so on. That's a big part of that. The second provision is the construction mitigation grants, and I think the senators had it right on the mark. We want to the existing language allows us to provide 5 grants. We want to provide 13 grants, still within the $100,000 appropriation limit that was granted in 2008, but just provide a few additional communities some funds to be able to provide some mitigation for construction impacts to small businesses generally.
So you could have done more than five because there were more applications. So how much were you giving out per grant?
Mr. Chair, the
apparently you're giving less than 10 grand.
Average amount.
Yeah. The average amount is less than $10,000.
And would that be consistent with the technical assistance that you would want to provide, or have you come up with an idea of what the amount might be there?
For the Minnesota Investment Fund piece of this?
Yes.
There are really two separate pieces, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota Investment Fund, we're looking at providing approximately $500,000 to be awarded to local governments who would then provide it to different types of business assistance organizations, such as a small business development center, to provide business assistance.
With the technical assistance?
Part? With the technical assistance, exactly.
And is it $500,000 something that you have in the fund already?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, it's dollars that are awarded through the federal government through a community development block grant, of which we take a share of that to fund through the investment fund about $2.5 to $3 million a year.
And then which government? How would one of the local governments qualify for the money?
We're in the process of developing a RFP that will be issued, and local governments, in partnership with a business council organization, will apply for those dollars.
And is there going to be a limit on the size of those grants?
Mr. Chair, we're expecting grants in the area of $100,000 per award.
So you're going to get five again?
That's what we're expecting in that particular piece of this.
Sure you don't want to make it bigger?
I mean the
five.
Mr. Chair, we're going to see what the quality of the responses are that reply to our RFP. We're not looking for any cap in this particular legislation. We just want the authority. So if we get some really good quality assistance projects, we may increase it, but if we're looking at assisting businesses directly, we may decrease it. We just want to have the flexibility to allow us to do this to help out some small businesses with their growth.
So do we have any other federal money laying around that we can tap into?
We don't have any, Mr. Chair, we don't have any federal dollars right now. Each year we get an allotment from the federal government for community development block grants.
This $500,000 is already in place?
It's coming through the community development block grant program.
Anybody have any comments or questions? Okay. Seeing none, then Senator Koch will move that Senate File 3206 be laid over for consideration for the omnibus policy bill from the Finance Division. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Koch.
Thank you.
Wednesday?
Oh, just a second.
Okay, our next meeting is Wednesday.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Kinosh.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to remind folks that on Thursday evening, we are going to have an opportunity to see Minnesota's forward thinking in transit-oriented development, green technology, new history opportunities around Fort Snelling, a modern airport, lots of progressive things that the state can build on. I think it's also an opportunity to probably tap more federal funds. So I'd invite all the members to come and have a very interesting presentation about some of the great things that are coming.
Are you buying pizza or anything?
Mr. Chair, I can possibly arrange that if that's what you're looking for. I'd be glad to.
Cap, is this going to be considered an
official? If a bribe is required, huh?
Okay, so this could be there will be attendance taken because this is an official committee meeting, just so you all know. So you don't want to have an absent by your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Meeting adjourned.